Relief flushed through her. She'd been feeling terrible about sullying Valentina's last moments with her grandmother, when in fact Valentina hadn't even registered it. Funny what kids noticed and what they didn't. As Sadie waited for Valentina to finish up, she inspected the display of silver-framed photos of the family on the wall. Her mother sitting on a park bench, holding baby Valentina in her lap and smiling broadly. Luann and Lonnie on their wedding day. Sadie and Lonnie standing stiffly in front of a Christmas tree next to their mother. Sadie's awkward stage had come and never left, unfortunately. She still had the same thick eyebrows and too small mouth. She stepped closer to the photo and studied it carefully, noticing that on top of all that, one of her eyes was slightly larger than the other, making her look loopy. She glanced in the mirror to check. Still loopy looking. Before, when she was married, there had been a wedding photo of her and Philip on the wall, one of her favorite shots of herself. She was smiling up at her new husband in profile. She'd always liked the curve of her nose from that angle, and her hair had been perfect that day, falling down her back in waves. Too bad she couldn't have just cut Philip out. Although he had looked rather sweet in it as well, a shy smile on his face, blushing as if he'd landed a princess. They had loved each other once. Sadie moved in closer to the one photo of their grandmother, taken in London before the war. She was standing by a rose bush with a faint smile on her face. Laura Lyons didn't seem like the jolliest of types. Her eyes were guarded, suspicious. The photo would have been taken around the time Virginia Woolf started writing her diaries. Maybe they'd bumped into each other, had tea together. Why had one woman saved her diaries for future generations, while the other demanded all her personal effects be destroyed after her death? The missing diary. Where on earth could it be? Sadie caught herself. She should be mourning the death of her mother, but instead the missing diary weighed more heavily. Or was she focusing on work to avoid dealing with the most recent family tragedy? If her mother were alive, she'd have been in the kitchen baking scones or some kind of fruit-filled pastry as a balm to their pain. The realization that she wasn't here to do that smashed into Sadie's solar plexus with a thud. She let out a sound that was half coughing, half choking, and suddenly it was as if a hole had opened up in her chest, leaving a void where her heart would be. Luann stepped into the room, one hand on the doorway. Everyone all right in here?
Sure, Mom, answered Valentina. Are there fortune cookies?
In the kitchen. Go for it. Luann came up behind Sadie as Valentina ran off.
The family photos.
She picked up one of Lonnie at his college graduation.
His best years. Look at all that hair.
Sadie tried to match her breeziness, although her voice was shaky.
Now he's still a charmer.
How's the geriatric gang going?
I think they'll be wrapping up soon.
She looked up as Lonnie joined them. Sadie turned to her brother.
I'm sorry I wasn't here for Mom's death. I feel bad about that.
Lonnie shrugged.
It was pretty uneventful. She just passed away quietly in her sleep.
We thought she was doing well, though, right?
We thought she was getting better.
She was recovering from the pneumonia, but in the night her heart stopped. She was 87, remember?
It just seems so sudden.
But it wasn't. Lonnie was right. Sudden was waking up in the middle of the night as an 8-year-old, confused, not sure of what she'd heard. It had been a loud thumping sound like someone had dropped a bag of potatoes. So Sadie had gotten up, drawn to the light of the bathroom, and gently pushed open the door to find her father on the cold tile, his legs askew, hands palms up, the long fingers slightly curved, like he was playing his bass. She'd rushed to her mother and then waited, kneeling on the floor of the hallway as the paramedics came. She still remembered the scratchiness of the carpet runner on her bare legs.
Their father had been a session musician, playing for advertisements and television shows before embracing the new rock and roll, one of the few older players who welcomed the new sound. He'd taken Sadie to the Brill Building a little north of Times Square a couple of times to listen in, and she'd been surprised at how much like a classroom the studio looked. A dozen folding chairs scattered across a linoleum floor. But her classroom didn't have wires snaking around chair legs and curling up microphone stands, or a dozen men smoking cigarettes during the breaks and teasing each other. When her father played his double bass, his body swayed like a tree in the wind, like he was dancing with a partner, Fred Astaire holding a maple and spruce ginger in his arms. When he was hired by the rock bands, he'd switched to a shiny electric Rickenbacker, the chunky strings no hindrance at all to his quick fingering. How Sadie missed him still, especially today. She supposed a death in the family did that, made you dredge up the silt from the bottom of your life. They stood quietly for a moment.
What was the last thing you said to her? Asked Sadie.
I think I told her to take her pills. She seemed out of sorts, confused.
Lonnie had a strange look on his face.
She mentioned the library of all things.
She did?
She looked at me like she was really looking at me, you know? Like she was completely lucid. Then she said something about how she had to leave the library because of the burning book.
Their mother had said something similar as Sadie was putting away the game, telling her not to burn a book. A burning book was the reason they had to leave the library? Asked Sadie. What did she mean?
No idea.
It was eerie, like she was terrified. Lonnie brushed away tears.
I comforted her, and she quieted down until, finally, she fell asleep.
Sadie's surviving spinsterhood book recommended every single girl find a hobby to keep her busy and interesting to others. Suggestions included collecting snuff boxes and antiquing, neither of which appealed. Instead, inspired by happy memories of her father, Sadie had begun seeking out music whenever she could. From the soaring voices of an oratorio in Carnegie Hall to the wild improvisations of a jazz club set in an old perfume factory, there was nothing better after a day of answering questions than to sit quietly in a room and let the melody transport her. The Saturday after Philip had left for good, desperate to get out of the apartment, she'd checked the listings in the New Yorker and settled on a small club in the West Village where a trio would be playing. She'd sat at the bar, feeling awkward and alone. But during the first set, a woman at a table right up front caught her eye. She had long gray hair and bright red lipstick and wore a fur stole from another era. She moved in time with the music, her shoulders swaying. That's what I'll be, decided Sadie. Unashamed. Unafraid. Tonight, though, 2 days after her mother's death, jazz wouldn't do. The stress that crawled up Sadie's spine and tangled in her brain required stronger fare. The band on stage at CBGB screamed out lyrics that she couldn't catch, but that didn't matter. It wasn't the point. She had taken her usual spot at the end of the bar closest to the door, where she could observe the room but not feel quite part of it. Tonight's band was a young punk trio without much flair but a ton of anger. The thick beating of the bass drum blasted itself into Sadie's head, almost hurting her ears but not quite. The bartender pointed to her beer, but Sadie declined another round, and he gave a slight sneer before turning away, as he always did when she showed up. The walls and ceiling were covered with a sordid mass of stickers and graffiti, the floor gummy and the beer warm. Bands with names like The Cramps called the club home, and the harsh sounds reflected the harsher realities outside its doors. The city was on edge, still uneasy after a bomb had exploded inside the World Trade Center's parking garage a couple of months ago. Sometimes she imagined her father playing at CBGB if he'd lived, delighting in the way the guitarists bent the sound with such ferociousness. When the club had opened its doors in the 70s, it had been a mecca for a new kind of sound, one that veered sharply away from the shimmery disco beats that were all the rage. 20 years later, it still thrummed with dark energy. Sadie loved to watch the dancing that wasn't really dancing, just limbs flailing about. Every few weeks, she'd stop by and recharge her batteries, and then she could go back out in the world and act like a fussy librarian again, sort through questions and supply answers, sink back into the logic and order of the Library of Congress classification system. Her desire to keep busy had drawn her back to work earlier that day, even though it was a Saturday and she was technically still on bereavement leave. Lonnie and Luann had taken care of the arrangements, which meant there was really nothing much for Sadie to do. At her desk in the quiet of the Berg, she'd left a phone message for Miss Quinn, Laura Lyons's former secretary and executor in London, before going back to the archives and wading through her grandfather's boxes again, hoping to find some crumb related to Laura Lyons that she'd missed the first time around. She soon became sidetracked by Jack Lyons's daily calendars. So many appointments and reminders. The man was certainly meticulous, just as Sadie was with her Filofax. She admired his attention to detail. List upon list of upcoming projects, weekly service appointments, coal prices. Then she'd reached the very last entry, dated the 23rd of May, 1914. The same month as the letter from the library detective saying that the family was under watch. Jack Lyons had written a short list, consisting of only three items. Stepladder, rope, note. A tidy checkmark was placed next to each one. Three words, innocent by themselves but thick with meaning together. She'd never known what happened to her grandfather, only that he'd died suddenly and the family had left the library. Could he have killed himself? Yet it seemed strange that he'd write a to-do list. So clinical, unemotional. What had happened back in May 1914 to Laura Lyons and her husband? And what about Pearl's deathbed utterances about burning books being the reason they had to leave? The past seemed murkier than ever, and Sadie worried over how the events from 80 years ago might reflect on her role of curator today, and not in a good way. Sitting at the bar at CBGB, letting the music wash over her, she mulled over what she'd learned. Stepladder, rope, note. If her grandfather had indeed killed himself, then Sadie's own father's death might have been even harder on Pearl than Sadie had imagined, even if it had been from natural causes. It also explained Pearl's reluctance to linger on the past. A young woman with piercings in her nose and a shaved head threw Sadie a smile as she passed by. That was nice, thought Sadie. She was a semi-regular by now, she supposed, and stood out from the other patrons in her tartan shirtwaist dress, circa 1940. Grunge fashion had nothing on her. She gathered her tote bag and went to the bathroom, waiting in the cramped space for an open stall.
Who's the grandma?
The voice came from one of the stalls and was answered by another.
The one at the end of the bar?
That's just some old bird who sits like a stone and pretends to be part of the scene. Pathetic, really.
Gus hates it because she takes up space and never orders more than one beer. God help me if I'm like that when I'm old.
Old? Sadie was only 43, she wanted to answer. But maybe they were talking about someone else, not her. The stall opened and the woman who'd acknowledged Sadie earlier stood frozen.
Hi.
Sadie turned, blinking back tears and walked out, back into the noise and mayhem. Monday morning, in the basement level of the library, Sadie pushed open the door marked binding and processing. She could have used up more of her bereavement leave, but she preferred to stay busy, and also didn't want Claude to swoop in and take her place in her absence. Inside, the room was set up like a mini factory, with long tables where various tools were laid out, empty save one man, who rose creakily to his feet as she neared, his gray beard almost white in the bright fluorescent lighting.
Mr. Babenko.
He greeted her warmly, as he had long ago when she'd first inquired about the hidden apartment. Mr. Babenko wasn't used to visitors, and had been delighted at Sadie's interest in the history of the building, as well as his work in the bindery, showing her how incoming books were measured and fitted with Mylar dust jackets, then run through a paste machine before being sent off to the stacks for shelving. She'd shown the appropriate admiration for the chunky metal over-sewing machine that stood, no longer used, in one corner, and they'd been friends ever since.
What's going on, young lady?
Young lady. The cruel remarks by the women at CBGB dissipated into thin air. It all came down to perspective, really. I don't know if you've heard, but we've had something go missing from the Berg collection.
Your curator?
Of course, Marlene. The news had spread fast. Right. She took a job in Boston. Chief of Collections.
Good for her.
But this is something else. He let out a whistle when she told him about the missing Virginia Woolf diary.
That's terrible news. Just terrible.
It certainly is. I have to ask you to keep this between us. Dr. Hooper doesn't want it leaking out.
You have my assurances, said Mr. Babenko. Was the diary marked?
The more valuable books at the New York Public Library were stamped with an identifying mark on page 97 as a way to prevent thefts. But even Sadie knew that some of the more nefarious bookshop owners were known to buy library books regardless, and would remove the mark by either mutilating that page or using chemicals to fade it. Every library with rare books and maps faced the same quandary. Whether to deface a book, which made it difficult to sell on the black market, or retain the book's purity and leave a tempting morsel for thieves. The Wolf wasn't marked, I know that for certain. I want to help find it if I can, but I'm not sure where to start.
For the most part, the people who have access to the books are the most likely suspects. Past thieves who have done the most serious damage to the collection are the same scholars who come to study the books. Respected patrons who become so enamored with their own expertise, they believe they should be the custodians of the material as well, or want to sell them for profit.
Sadie, Claude, and Marlene had always kept a close eye on the Berg's visitors, who after all had to go through a strict approval process before even gaining entry. The intimacy of the room helped in that regard as well. The librarian's desks are only a few feet away from the tables where our visitors sit. We're practically on top of each other.
You can't trust anyone. I remember reading about a case 20 or so years ago, where two Byzantine priests were caught smuggling a rare Dutch atlas out of the Yale library. Turns out they'd taken hundreds of books, not only from Yale, but also from Dartmouth, Harvard, and Notre Dame.
What happened to them?
They were defrocked and sentenced to a year and a half in prison.
A year and a half, that's all? She must have misheard him.
That's all. An absolute shame.
Okay, so I'll be on the lookout for men in robes. She paused. On a different note, I have a strange question. Do you remember hearing about anyone who committed suicide in the library? Say, a really long time ago?
Not that I know of. Why do you ask?
She had to come clean. Well, almost clean. I discovered a letter that said that the superintendent of the building, the one who lived in the apartment, was a suspected book thief back in 1914, and I think he may have committed suicide.
I can't help you there, but we do have a couple of ghosts who like to wander about.
You mean the worker who fell off the scaffolding in the reading room when it was being built? She smiled. The ghost was a common legend among the staff, although no one she'd known had ever seen it firsthand.
The very one. Mr. Babenko picked at the dry skin on his hands. I meant what I said, you know, about the people closest to the Berg collection being the prime suspects.
You mean Claude and Marlene? The timing of Marlene's new job had to be a coincidence. Marlene was devoted to the collection, to its preservation. As for Claude, Sadie had been keeping a close eye on him ever since the theft.
Not just Claude and Marlene, Mr. Babenko replied. You too, Sadie. You too.
Chapter 7. New York City, 1913.
I said, give the bag here!
Laura stepped back, deeper into the tenement apartment, even though every instinct told her to make a run for the door, get away from the menacing creature standing before her. But doing so meant going past him, and he'd easily block her way with his bulk. Look, I'm a student reporter from Columbia, just visiting, really. Your son, she looked over at the boy, asked me to come up. There must have been some kind of mistake. She hated the way her voice rose at the end of the sentence. The mother of the family cowered while her husband roared at Laura.
What? You're a reporter? What kind of reporting do you think you're doing? Going to write up a sob story about our sad little family, hungry and cold?
He leered at his wife.
I say we toss this one out the window.
No one will be tossing anyone. The statement came from somewhere near the front door, behind the man, whose head swiveled like an owl's at the sound. Mr. Marino, stand down. Now. A woman, tall and commanding, pushed past him, giving him a good shove as she did so. Her shoulders were wide, her brown hair parted in the middle and pulled back in a bun so tight, Laura wondered if she didn't get headaches. A necktie was secured around her neck by a stiff collar, and she wore round spectacles that lent her an owlish air. Something about her seemed familiar, but in Laura's relief at the rescue, she was unable to figure out what. Everyone leave except me, the mother, and the babe. The boy handed over the baby to the newcomer, and the gang of children skipped out, delighted at the reprieve from work. The larger ones jostled the younger ones, who barely stayed on their feet as they all funneled through the doorframe. The father, grudgingly, disappeared into the back room off the kitchen, after looking Laura up and down like she was a side of beef swinging on a butcher's hook. Once he was gone, the woman surveyed the space, nodding. You've kept the window open. Well done, Mrs. Marino. I'm sorry, I should go, said Laura. The other students would be heading back to Columbia now, armed with quotes and stories, while she'd almost gotten killed. You say you're a reporter? Well, a student reporter. From Columbia. Then you stay. Take notes. Write the story. No one else is interested. Laura didn't dare say no. She'd never seen a woman take charge like this, with no hesitation, ordering everyone about as if she were the captain of a sea liner. Sit there. Laura dutifully took a seat at the head of the table. The baby isn't eating much, offered Mrs. Marino, who slumped in the chair opposite Laura. Now that her family was gone, she seemed smaller, sadder, lost. Since when? Since yesterday. The woman placed the baby in Mrs. Marino's arms. Talk to her. Mrs. Marino guffawed. Why? She can't talk back. Go ahead, say something. Anything. Mrs. Marino looked out into space, like she was trying to come up with a phrase. She shrugged and then finally obeyed. Are you sleepy? In response, the child smiled. The mother looked up, pleased. Well done, Mrs. Marino. I'm sorry, may I ask your name? Laura said, pulling her notebook out of the satchel. Dr. Potter. I work for the city. Dr. Potter took the baby from Mrs. Marino and placed her carefully on the tabletop. With the practiced efficiency, she undid the child's swaddling and performed a physical examination. We're executing a new program, where newborns are visited within a day of delivery, with regular follow-ups. The baby let out a giggle, and Dr. Potter giggled back. Mrs. Marino, can you let this reporter know what I've been yammering on about these past few months? The woman leaned forward, suddenly eager to win the doctor's approval. Dr. Potter had that effect. She took up space without apologizing for it, like a huge pine among saplings. Mrs. Marino counted on her fingers. Let fresh air into the rooms. Bathe her every few days. Don't give the baby beer. And I told the others to stop playing in the gutter, like you said. Well done. You're my star pupil today, I have to say. The mother beamed. Do you pick her up when she cries? asked Dr. Potter. The mother threw the child a guilty glance. I never did with the others. My own mother said you have to ignore them, or they'll grow up to be weak. Human contact is essential for a child's development. Dr. Potter's answer was swift and emphatic, as if she'd said it 100 times before. Comforting your baby is perfectly fine. She finished up and handed the baby back to her mother. Try nursing her now. What is this new program all about? Asked Laura. We're trying to reduce child mortality, starting in this district. I'm a medical inspector. Never seen an inspector before you lot showed up, offered Mrs. Marino. Dr. Potter didn't seem surprised. The ones I've met, all men, by the way, had a habit of faking records of their home visits. Never mind that last summer, 1,500 babies died, either from tainted milk or overswaddling. The basics of child care can save thousands of lives. I lead a group of inspectors who have been doing home visits, actual home visits. Have you seen an improvement? Laura asked. This past summer, the number of infant deaths dropped to 300. Down from 1,500? Laura sat back, stunned. How? What you see me doing here? Talking sense to women who understand logic, like you, Mrs. Marino. By now, the baby was in her mother's lap, sucking at one breast, gazing up in that love-drunk way that Laura had observed with both of her children. She'd read nothing about this remarkable program in the newspapers, not a word. She said as much as they walked back out into the street. Maternal health, the health of the babies of poor immigrant women, is not a priority in this city at this time, said Dr. Potter. She pulled a pocket watch out from her shirtwaist. I must move on. She held out a hand to shake Laura's, and in that gesture, Laura realized how she knew her. From Vassar. Amelia Potter had been a student at the college a few years ahead of Laura. At the time, she'd looked quite different, with a softer hairstyle and no spectacles. I know you from college, Laura said. As she spoke, the image of Amelia sitting in the grass, surrounded by other girls, came to mind. Laura had joined, sitting slightly apart, nervous about her young age compared to the rest. Amelia sat not in the proper way, with her legs folded neatly under her to one side, but like a man might, her legs cross-legged underneath her, not caring that one knee was exposed. She was reading aloud from a book that was all the rage, The Awakening by Kate Chopin. Home from break, Laura had mentioned it at the dinner table, but her father had cut her off, saying that it was about a woman who puts her own needs ahead of those of her children and husband, ultimately meeting a tragic end. An abomination, her father called it. She'd wondered when he'd read it, but knew better than to ask. Amelia, on that sunny fall day, had read loudly, proudly, from the text, while the girls around her tittered and shared knowing glances. At the time, Laura couldn't help but stare at Amelia, whose confidence was so much greater than her own. One day, I'll be like that, she'd vowed. Well, she wasn't quite that confident, as her interaction with the Marinos had demonstrated. But with each test, she would become a little braver, she was certain. That was why she'd enrolled in the journalism school in the first place, to be challenged. Dr. Potter regarded Laura. I don't remember you. When were you there? 1900. I was younger than the rest, and finished earlier, to get married. I'm Laura Lyons now. By now, they'd reached the L train. Well, Laura Lyons? I wish you luck in your current studies. Thank you. And you with your program. Laura turned to climb the stairs. I say, Mrs. Lyons, you might be interested in coming to the Heterodoxy Club next week, if you're free. The what? Laura had never heard the term before and wasn't sure what it even meant. It's a luncheon club held in Greenwich Village every other Saturday. For women who aren't afraid to speak their minds, you might enjoy it. She pulled out a card from her satchel and scribbled an address, date, and time on the back. Do come. Laura began writing her article on the train back to Columbia, so that once she reached the city room, all she had to do was type it up, her fingers flying, making small fixes as she went. After everyone's copy was handed in, Professor Wakeman read through them out loud, offering suggestions as he spoke, placing ones he felt worthy of being on the front page in a separate pile. Finally, he got to Laura's piece. He stopped after the first paragraph and looked over at her.
You met this Dr. Potter in person?
Yes. I happened to be there during a home visit. He carried on reading, making no corrections or suggestions.
Did you make this up?
Laura stiffened. Of course not. It's all true. They've saved hundreds of babies' lives in a year.
Then why haven't I read about this elsewhere?
Dr. Potter's words came back to Laura. Because no one cares about immigrants' babies. He regarded Laura.
This is front page, no doubt.
She grinned as her story was placed on the top of the pile. Even if it wouldn't be read by anyone other than her professor and the other students for now, once she'd graduated, she'd make this her first pitch to her editor and get the word out about the remarkable efforts of Dr. Amelia Potter. She couldn't wait. After his initial disapproval, Professor Wakeman had warmed up to Laura and allowed her to dig into the women's assignments from whatever quirky angle she came up with. When they were assigned to cover a suffragist parade in Brooklyn, she hung back at the end of the march with the anti-suffragists, dressed in red and black, who grabbed banners and tore them in half. Some of her articles for the student newspaper fell flat, but she continued to find a way to make each one her own. With each passing week, her writing improved, and she ended up on the front page more often than not.
You're thinking of your next article, aren't you?
Said Jack with a sly smile as they walked up Fifth Avenue on Christmas Eve. The children skipped ahead, eager to arrive at their grandparents' house and open their gifts right off. We're on break. Until next month, there's nothing to think on. She nudged him with her elbow. Well, all right, yes. How could you tell?
I recognize it in myself. When I'm lost in thought, I'm sure I get the same look in my eyes. Far away.
He'd been staying up later and later working on his manuscript. The dark circles under his eyes worried her, but he seemed happier than ever. Giddy some evenings, when he crawled next to her in bed, reaching for her under her nightgown and pressing close. That giddiness had made him the center of attention back when they first met, when he was a young, soon-to-be-famous author who liked nothing better than to exchange quips in a room full of other soon-to-be-famous types. Before the hard work of writing a book had chipped away at his confidence.
I know you've enjoyed school immensely so far.
Jack turned serious, looking down at her with pity. The scholarship that Dr. Anderson had arranged wouldn't cover next term, and she'd approached the provost of the school, hoping for some financial assistance, but apparently there were no more funds available. Her story ideas meant nothing if she couldn't attend classes. Don't worry. I'm sure it will all work out, she said.
I'm sure it will. But if it doesn't, can you defer a year?
No. That's not the way it works. She offered up what she hoped was a brave smile. Our only chance lies in this evening's festivities. Don't let my father get to you. Not tonight.
Best behavior, I promise.
Harry glanced back at his parents. You already told us that. I said I would behave. Not you, my love. Your father. Relief flooded Harry's face before he broke into a grin. Father's in trouble? He will be, If he doesn't say please and thank you at the table and be careful not to make a spill?
I never spill!
Jack waved his arms about like a windmill, making Harry double over with glee. Pearl, meanwhile, carried on, refusing to acknowledge the ridiculous antics of the male members of her family. They had so much to be grateful for this holiday season. Harry had started making friends, finally, even if he didn't get the same glowing reports from his teachers that his sister did. Jack was happy at work, and Laura adored graduate school. Now, if she could only stay on. The Christmas tree in the parlor dripped with garlands and ornaments, a contrast to the empty bookshelves where valuable vases had once been displayed, and the bare spot where the grand piano had stood. The glass bulbs on the tree couldn't be sold off, or at least weren't worth the effort, but the lavish decorations only made the gloomy room, electric lights dimmed to save a few extra cents, feel off balance. Laura hated to bring up the subject of money with her mother and father. At the same time, they were her last hope. Her mother hugged the children in turn, while her father greeted them stiffly, glaring at the unseemly show of emotion. His eyebrows rose up into black arches when he was disappointed or dismayed, and became an angry slash when crossed. A man pickled in misery. The maid brought out sherry for the grown-ups and chocolate for the children, who took one sip before racing to the tree and plucking out the gifts with their names. Laura sat on the settee with Jack and exclaimed politely as the presents were opened, although their contents barely registered in her mind. "How is your journalism course, my dear?" her mother asked as the maid cleared away the wrapping paper and ribbons. She'd hoped to put off the conversation until later, at least during dinner. But Jack gave her a quick nod that she knew meant it was better to address the situation right off. He was right. Doing so gave them time to warm up to the idea. "It's brilliant. Everything I expected. By May, I'll be able to find a well-paying job with the connections I'm making."
"Women ought not to be working."
Her father gestured to where Pearl and Harry were engrossed in a game of jacks on the floor.
"Your children need you."
So many rebuttals came to Laura's mind. That if her mother had found a job so that the sole burden didn't fall upon her husband, the tension and blame in the household might have been lessened considerably. That if her mother had followed her heart. Her mother sat, smiling, perched on the end of her chair. She'd been a handsome young woman once, before the lines crinkled her white skin and her hair turned gray. Now she was brittle, though she still retained some of the bubbliness of her youth. When Laura was a little girl, she would often sneak into her mother's dressing chamber and sit at the vanity, where the jewelry box was kept. She'd load up her arms with thick bracelets and place diamond-encrusted pins in her hair, like an empress. One day, she'd reached for a brooch and discovered the box had a false bottom. Underneath lay a locket containing a lock of strawberry blonde hair. "He was my first beau," her mother had said when Laura had softly inquired that evening at bedtime. "I loved him more than anything, but we weren't deemed a good match."
"Why not?"
"He didn't have the resources to take care of me." She'd leaned in close. "I promise you I won't let you make the same mistake."
"Mistake?"
"I want you to marry whomever you love." She'd stayed true to her word, forcing the issue with her husband when Jack had asked for Laura's hand in marriage. The impending baby, of course, had a great deal of influence in that matter. But where her father had sulked through the wedding, Laura's mother had beamed with happiness. Laura wore a locket with Jack's hair around her neck now. It wouldn't be hidden away, ever.
"Are you listening to me?"
"I said, your children need you." Laura's father, his cheeks red, gestured like a conductor from where he sat in a leather wingback chair. They're both fine, I assure you. Mother has been helping out when I'm at class. Laura took a sip of sherry and placed it on the side table. There is one problem, however.
Is there?
The eyebrows lifted. I received a scholarship for the first term, but I'm afraid I'm slightly short on the coming one. She sensed her mother stiffen.
How much?
Asked her father. $100. But I'll repay you as soon as I start working.
Jack leaned forward. With luck, my book will sell next year, in which case we could repay you sooner.
Laura had told him to keep quiet, and now he'd gone and said something sure to make her father turn against the request. The eyebrows turned into two nasty arrows, practically touching in the middle of her father's forehead.
Another novelist. Just what the city needs.
He turned to Laura.
And yet another journalist, raking the muck.
The things I'm learning at journalism school are important and will make a difference in the world. For example, I've done a story on a doctor, a woman doctor, who saved the lives of thousands of babies in the slums. The professor said the story was worthy of being in a real paper, like the New York Times. A woman doctor?
Her mother nodded encouragingly, her eyes darting to her husband and back to Laura.
That's lovely. Her name is Dr. Potter. I went to school with her at Vassar, added Laura. Her father scowled, unimpressed. He addressed his wife as if they were the only people in the room.
Exactly. Laura's already been to Vassar, not sure why she needs more schooling.
Darling, I remember you saying that she'd meet the best of the best at university.
I did.
You certainly did. And you were right about that.
His eyebrows settled into a neutral line. Progress.
I've come this far. It's only for another 5 months. Please. She thought of her father turning up day after day to an office where his was the only desk, all the clerks having been let go years before. Having lunch exactly at noon, going over the figures again and again, watching the balance decline. You always said one shouldn't quit. Laura caught a quick glance between her parents, full of worry and fear, and her guilt at having placed them in this position increased. If there was any other way to procure the funds, she would have taken it instead of adding to their woes. But they were her last hope. Her father's pride meant that he wouldn't dare admit how much a loan would cost him. Her mother's love, neither.
No, Laura, said her father. We simply cannot help you.
Her mother turned to the children. I have some sweets for you, if you like. The children cheered and followed her into the living room. The conversation was over. An hour later, as they gathered their coats and made to leave, Laura's mother pulled her aside and pressed something hard into Laura's palm. Take this. Sell it. Don't tell your father. I'll say that I lost it. She pushed Laura out the door, waving a manic goodbye. Laura opened her hand when they were a block away, although she already knew what lay there. Her mother's engagement ring, a deep navy sapphire surrounded by a halo of diamonds. As they neared the library, she whispered to Jack what had happened. I didn't have a chance to give it back, to say anything. Father was right there.
Why would you give it back?
Jack held the door open for her as they entered the library.
Looks like you might have another term of school after all. Brilliant, my love.
She didn't feel brilliant. Dr. Anderson stood in the center of the library foyer, speaking to a gaunt man with small black eyes. It was Christmas Eve, when the employees should have been home with their families. Something was amiss. Laura sent the children upstairs. Dr. Anderson greeted Laura and Jack and introduced the man as the library detective, Mr. Gaylard.
I'm afraid we've had more trouble,
They drew close.
There's been another theft of a rare book, Tamerlane.
Laura couldn't help but gasp. She'd seen the book before, soon after the library had opened, and a few of the highlights of the collection had been put on display, the Gutenberg Bible, the Shakespeare First Folio, and Tamerlane. She'd peered in through the glass of the vitrine and wished desperately she could touch the small, thin volume with an olive cover, written by Edgar Allan Poe, one of her favorites. One of only a few left in the world, stated the card beside it. And now it was missing. Laura and Jack discussed the theft in hushed tones as they climbed the stairs to the apartment. In the parlor, Harry and Pearl were bickering over how best to hang their stockings on the fireplace, but stopped mid-argument, studying their parents' faces.
What's wrong? Asked Pearl. Are we in trouble?
Not at all, my love, said Jack. It's my work. A very important book called Tamerlane has gone missing.
Laura refused to allow Jack's work to cast a damper on their holiday festivities. Luckily, they have smart men looking for it, so I have no doubt it'll turn up by New Year's. Now let's get a hammer and a couple of nails and get your stockings ready for Santa's visit.
As the children's cheers and excitement filled the air, Laura's unease at the news was quickly erased, lost in the pandemonium of the holiday season. The day after Christmas, Laura had hoped she might be able to go up to Columbia University's library to check out the books mentioned in next semester's syllabus, but Pearl and Harry were fighting over their Christmas presents, and Jack, who'd earlier that morning promised to stay with them, had disappeared with Mr. Gaylard right after breakfast. Finally, around 2 o'clock, he returned, his face weary. Any luck with the missing books? Laura asked.
Nothing yet.
Why don't I fix you something to eat?
Once he was settled, she could grab her satchel and head uptown, fit in a couple of hours at least. But Jack shook off the offer.
I'm worried about all this. How this reflects on me as superintendent.
You don't think they suspect you, do you?
Not exactly, but I know this place so well. Better than anyone. You would think I'd be able to determine how the thief is getting in and out, but I don't have a clue. How about you come down to the stacks with me? Without Gaylard breathing down my neck, I'll be able to see it more clearly.
Laura suppressed a sigh. Of course, my love. She tucked away her satchel. Deep in the basement, Laura breathed in the acrid odor from the bindery, where the library's books were repaired. They went down a long hall into the shipping room, where Jack unlocked a door that led right into the stacks.
We can't figure out how the thief got inside the cages.
What cages?
Laura had had a quick tour of the stacks, 7 stories of shelving located directly below the main reading room when they'd first arrived.
I don't remember seeing cages.
I'll show you.
Natural light for the stacks spilled in through a series of long, narrow windows that ran down the length of the building. From Bryant Park, the effect was striking and modern. Inside, the design provided airiness to what was basically a book repository. The cast iron shelves were painted white, with each row assigned a number. Metal stairways offered access between each section. They passed by brass pneumatic tubes that glistened like snakes.
This is where the call slips from the catalog room and the main reading room end up, and are handed to whatever page is assigned to that section, said Jack.
She imagined the stacks during library hours, with pages traversing back and forth, piling up books in the dumbwaiters for quick retrieval.
How do you know that it isn't a librarian or a page, since they're the ones with the most access?
The keys to the cages are limited to the head librarians and me.
She studied the space. Do the windows open?
No.
Where are these cages?
Follow me.
As they walked, she couldn't help herself.
How's the manuscript coming along?
I find I'm slowing down as I reach the end, like I do when I'm reading a book that I love.
Slowing down? She knew she should stay quiet, but she couldn't help herself. Boy, I wish we had that luxury in class. With a deadline, it's amazing how fast you get things done. Journalists don't get paid if they don't write, so it becomes less precious. Her enthusiastic delivery did nothing to hide the snippiness of her words. Part of her didn't care, though. Just get on with it already.
You're a student journalist, not a journalist, yet.
She wouldn't back down. Maybe if you gave yourself a deadline, you'd reach the end faster. Easter, or something like that.
Fiction is a creative process. You can't compare the two. It can't be rushed.
One section of the stacks, in the northeast corner, was set off from the rest by a wire cage that encircled two bookcases, around 20 feet in length. As Jack fiddled with the lock, Laura clutched the wire with her fingers and gave it a shake. Seems pretty solid.
You'd need wire cutters to get through these.
She peered inside. It's like a rare book zoo. Do you remember when we took the children to the Bronx Zoo? How Pearl growled back at the tiger?
Fearless, our Pearl.
The lock finally clicked, and he held open the wire door for her to step inside.
Harry could use some of her gumption.
He pointed to the shelf that held the oversized books, some of which were in labeled gray boxes.
This is the Gutenberg Bible, one of 48 copies that survive from the mid-1400s. And over here is one of Shakespeare's first folios.
These books had suffered through hundreds of years of handling without falling apart, without being lost or damaged. They were each a piece of history, invaluable and precious. She stepped back, glancing along the shelves. So this is the section where the Leaves of Grass and Tamerlane were kept?
Yes.
Were they checked out by anyone? Did you figure out who last asked to see them? He sighed. Of course they had, but she was just trying to be helpful. Sorry, she said. I'm sure you've been over this a million times with Mr. Gaylard.
Not quite a million, but close.
He locked the cage door carefully, checking it twice to make sure the lock was secure. His hands, so large around the key, reminded her just how strong he was, how faithfully he'd taken care of their family and provided them with everything they needed. She remembered how much she'd enjoyed watching him up at the estate, taking his place alongside the other men to help mend a stone wall, heaving rocks into place as if they were made of air. She shouldn't have made him feel bad about his book earlier. He was doing the best he could. She wrapped her hands around his waist and reached up to kiss the back of his neck.
Careful. We've added another night watchman. We don't want to cause trouble.
He smiled.
Well, not here, anyway.
Laura followed him along the row to the staircase. What else is kept in the cage?
Manuscripts, letters, maps.
Maybe one day your book will be in there. Imagine that. In 100 years, when you're a famous author, they'll have all your first drafts lined up on the shelf next to Shakespeare. He nodded gamely, and she immediately regretted saying anything, as it only added to his pressure. But it was probably just temporary, a part of a creative writer's natural cadence. She shouldn't blame herself for that. It wasn't her fault. Chapter 8. New York City, 1914. Greenwich Village was very different from Laura's Fifth Avenue neighborhood. All narrow streets at odd angles, the buildings a mix of livery stables, tenements, cafes, and saloons. Recently, the low rents had attracted a new set of residents who called themselves bohemians and didn't mind the fact that the apartments tended to be small and dingy. All part of the charm, Laura supposed.
Even in winter, village streets thrummed with energy, men and women spilling out of restaurants or animatedly chatting in front of a bakery, the windows slick with steam. She turned down McDougal Street and found the address for Polly Holiday's restaurant. Inside, she paused, her nerves catching up with her. Men and women sat at long wooden trestle tables, drinking together. Her father would have had a fit if he knew his daughter was indulging in such scandalous behavior. Near the back, she caught sight of Amelia speaking with a woman with bobbed hair and wearing what looked like a meal sack and leather sandals. In February. As Amelia greeted Laura, the woman was swept up the stairs by another group. Laura couldn't help herself. What is she wearing? That's nothing. If you visit Henrietta at home, you'll often find her in her birthday suit. A practicing feminist and nudist, our girl Henny. Laura memorized the phrase. What a quote. Since the new semester had begun, she'd been struggling to come up with an idea for her thesis assignment. 9,000 words on a single topic, with Professor Wakeman as her advisor. While Dr. Potter's invitation had initially slipped her mind in the craziness of the holidays, the bi-weekly meetings of the Heterodoxy Club now seemed like a timely opportunity. She followed Amelia upstairs to a large meeting room, where avant-garde artwork competed for attention with an assortment of sofas and chairs, all upholstered in bright citrus colors. They scrunched into a love seat near the front as a woman called for attention and recited the day's agenda. Laura was just reaching into her satchel for her notebook when the woman's words stopped her mid-reach. As we've said in the past, the comments and discussions that take place at the Heterodoxy Club are considered off the record, so members may speak their minds freely. Some of us have experienced firsthand how our words may be twisted by those who wish to demean and deride the causes we delve into over these 3 hours. This afternoon, you need not fear that. No note-taking. She straightened up, curious to see what this was all about. Margaret Sanger spoke first, about fighting the obscenity laws that prevented her from publishing and disseminating information regarding contraception to the women who most needed it. She used words that Laura had never heard spoken out loud, like pessary and condom, coitus interruptus, and talked of douching with carbolic acid or Lysol as a preventative measure. The room was brought to tears with her story of a young Jewish immigrant woman who begged her doctor for birth control, was refused, and then died in childbirth of septicemia. In that moment, I resolved that women should have knowledge of contraception, Sanger told them. They have every right to know about their own bodies. I would scream from the housetops. I would tell the world what was going on in the lives of these poor women. I would be heard. No matter the cost, I would be heard. Amelia clapped with fervor. How brave to be on the front lines of change, the way these women around Laura were. There was a sizzle of anger in the room, but not in the way that the newspapers usually described, equating the new woman with rabid anti-establishment radicalism. The ideas being bandied about were radical, yes, but opposition arose with frequency, and everyone got a say. When the talk turned to the suffrage movement, equal time was spent discussing whether gaining the right to vote in what was an inherently male, corrupt electoral system was even worth the effort, a perspective Laura hadn't ever considered. By the time the 3 hours were up, Laura had enough material to write 90,000 words, never mind 9,000. The Heterodoxy Club made a perfect subject for her thesis. It fulfilled Professor Wakeman's requirement that she cover a women's topic, but unlike most of his assignments, this one actually mattered, and Laura found herself intrigued by the ideas of the new woman. She felt a twinge of guilt when she remembered that it was supposed to remain off the record before setting aside the mandate. Since the thesis was just practice and not for publication, she wouldn't be breaking any rules. Maybe later, after she'd graduated and gotten to know these women better, she'd approach them for permission. But for now, she was just a student learning her craft. The group broke up, and Laura joined Amelia and a few of the others downstairs in the restaurant. She wasn't ready to leave, not yet. Their table was made up of a lawyer, an actress, and a couple of authors. Not one woman spoke of her children, if they had any, nor their spouses. Laura realized with a shock that all had achieved financial independence. Her thoughts were interrupted by the woman sitting across from her. "You're not a monotonist, are you?" "I'm sorry, a what?" Amelia put her hand on Laura's arm, a protective gesture that Laura appreciated. She wasn't part of this group, really. The causes, women's suffrage, birth control, she supported, of course, but she was only a student reporter and didn't want to get too caught up. Still, part of her wanted to impress Amelia, or at the very least, not embarrass her. She had lost touch with the few women friends she'd made when she and Jack had lived in the country, and the isolation of residing in a library hadn't helped matters. A thin, invisible thread stretched between her and Amelia, a result of their shared alma mater, and she didn't want to see it dissolve because she was deemed to be too conservative for this downtown crowd. "A monotonist is a woman who marries young, has children, and remains mated," the woman explained. "I suppose I am. For now." Laura wasn't sure why she tacked on the last two words. She had no intention of leaving Jack, but her life appeared so stodgy compared to the others. She lived in a marble mausoleum right on Fifth Avenue, for goodness sake, a far cry from a charming village flat with flower boxes in the windows. "What's the alternative?" "A varietist. Exactly what the name implies." The woman introduced herself as Florence. "Varietists try many different iterations of relationships. Men, women, all the combinations you can think of. Open marriage, for example. Why do you think we want to legalize birth control? So we can love freely, without fear." Amelia jumped in. "Don't try to shock our new member, Flo."
"I'm not shocked," said Laura. "But you won't sell your cause with such talk. The rest of society associates free love with prostitution, with the corruption of the family dynamic. It's all wrapped up together." The very phrase, "the corruption of the family dynamic," is another way of keeping women downtrodden, said Amelia. "The family dynamic only works if there's someone, the woman, who is tasked with the drudgery of child-rearing and housekeeping. If her mind and energy are freed up to take on more pressing concerns, the world will turn on its head." Even though she partly agreed, Laura couldn't help but push back. "I object to the use of drudgery in the same sentence as child-rearing. My children are a delight, a wonder. Their laundry, not so much," she thought to herself. "We have many mothers in the club," said Amelia. "The two ideas aren't exclusive. We're more concerned with making sure that mothers can dictate how many children they wish to have and how far apart to give birth, a measure of control that frees up their economic power." The conversation veered off in a new direction, ideas and phrases bandied about in a whirl, social and moral repression, liberation, feminism. Already, the thesis was practically writing itself in her head. "If you're interested in writing about public health, I have the perfect book for you," said Amelia, digging through a desk piled high with letters and notebooks. "Here it is." At Amelia's urging, Laura had walked back with her to her apartment on Patchin Place, an alley off 10th Street. She knew she should head home and start making dinner, but part of her wanted to find out how Amelia lived her life, as it was so different from her own. The rooms were small but comfortable, with a rocking chair near the fireplace and filled with color, much like the meeting hall for the club had been. Laura had tried to make her own apartment in the library cozy, but the strange layout, part public space, part private, had stymied her efforts, and compared to this charming flat, she'd failed dismally. Yet she couldn't help but notice that Patchin Place had yet to be modernized, with the hand pump at the sink and metered gas flares providing heat and light. At least they had an indoor commode at the library. While Laura's decorating skills could be improved upon, an outhouse certainly could not. She took the book that Amelia gave her and tucked it under the notebook in her lap. She'd hinted that she was interested in covering Amelia's work as part of her studies, which was true, even though she saw it more as part of the thesis, an inside look at the ladies of the club. "What made you decide to study medicine?" asked Laura. Amelia sat beside her on the couch, her arm resting along the back. Her hair was naturally curly, the swirls beginning to release from the hold of the pomade in the dry heat of the room. She'd taken off the stiff collar she wore and loosened her necktie, much in the way that Jack did when he came home. Yet her obviously ample cleavage swelled under the shirtwaist like a Gibson girl's, a strange mix of feminine and masculine. "I decided to become a doctor when my father and brother both died of typhoid within 6 months of each other," said Amelia. "Not because I had some silly notion that I could have saved them. The only thing that could have saved them is if sewage hadn't been dumped in the Hudson River. But I was left to take care of my mother, and I needed a profession that paid."
"I'm so sorry. That must have been awful."
They sat in silence for a moment. "That day we met, in that tenement, are most of your appointments like that?"
"Oh, that was nothing. I remember as an intern going to tend to a birth in a tenement in Hell's Kitchen. The woman's back was blistered. She was in terrible pain, because apparently her husband had come home drunk and thrown hot water at her. As soon as she told me that, he appeared, drunk off his rocker. He tried to come at me, but I sidestepped him out into the hallway, where I gave him a huge push, down the stairs."
Laura gasped. She waited, uncertain. "What happened?"
"I went back and delivered his child. On my way out, I kicked him in the leg and he swore at me, so it turns out I didn't kill him. Not that it would have bothered me much."
"Really?"
Amelia suddenly looked exhausted. "No, that's not true. I would have been inconsolable if I'd killed him, to be honest. I'm a doctor, after all." The melancholy in Amelia's voice made Laura want to offer what comfort she could.
"You must see so much despair."
"I can't get sentimental about it. You see these mothers with their sick babies, and they have such fatalism in their eyes. They know they'll probably lose that child, as well as the one after. When my nurses and I first show up, they're suspicious of our motives. But as their babies remain healthy, gain weight, and grow, their trust in us grows as well. They become eager to please, happy to brag of their progress."
"Can I ask why you dress the way you do? Is it so that the men in the tenements don't bother you while you work?"
Amelia laughed. "No. It's so the other doctors don't bother me, and not in the way you're inferring. If I show up wearing lace and ruffles, they'll talk down to me, dismiss me and my ideas. So I dress as much like them as possible without being indecent. Just recently, one of the doctors, a good fellow, this one, was complaining to me about the nurses for their vile feminine ways, and I had to stop him and ask, 'What kind of creature do you think I am?' His eyes went wide, and, I swear, it suddenly dawned on him that he had been speaking to me as one of his own gender. I couldn't have been happier. Besides, it's more comfortable." She lifted her skirt and straightened out one leg. "If I could wear trousers, I'd do that.
Or a sack, like Henrietta. That too. But I imagine it's itchy.
probably. From outside came the faint cries of children playing in the alley, reminding Laura that she really should go home. What about you? Asked Amelia. What do I like to wear? She couldn't help joking. Very funny. What do you want to do with your degree? Write about things like this. Your work, the changes the city is going through, the changes that women are going through. This is the place, then. You won't get a more progressive crowd than here in Greenwich Village, although you're already too late. I hear that someone started giving paid tours of an artist's garret off of Washington Square, aimed at attracting visitors to the city and the uptown crowd. He set up an artist's studio in one room, an actress's bedroom in another, and hired appropriately bohemian-looking people.